Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, as always, joined by my friend John. What's happening?
Dude, it is another great day in Kentucky and excited to be here. How are you, man?
Doing really well. We had our Halloween episode drop. We've been getting more and more reviews for Paradigm. We had a great bonus episode that came out yesterday with Brent Reeves. Such an incredible storyteller. You know, you meet people that do things that you do and make you feel inferior. I felt like I was in the presence of somebody who does storytelling the right way.
Little backstory on that interview. Brent Reeves is a part of the Bear Grease podcast. So if you want to listen to more Brent Reeves after you listen to yesterday's show or the interview, you can go look up Bear Grease. And every Friday, Brent Reeves releases an episode called This Country Life. And it is just some of the best stories I've ever heard. But the tie-in for True Crime Cast was that Brent was a career law enforcement officer. He was a police officer for nearly 33 years. And we asked him to just come on and talk about some funny police stories, and he did not disappoint.
And he told some, I mean, there's a little bit of intensity there, too. It's all not light and fuzzy.
The middle story, he said, oh, this is funny. And then he started, I was like, this is not funny. This is not. This is intense. I don't know what humor you found in this.
I still don't know that it was funny, but it was wildly entertaining. Even my wife listened to that episode, so I highly encourage everybody to, if you missed it.
I am a huge fan of anything that Bear Grease does, especially Brent Reeves. So just the fact that he took his time to come on the show was humbling. I am a fanboy for sure. Awesome. I tried to contain myself.
Awesome experience. You did great. Got a couple people that have written some new reviews we'd like to thank. This comes from Jersey Girl in Vermont. Says, easy to listen to. These two guys are fabulous, interesting topics. I really enjoy this podcast. So thank you, Jersey Girl in Vermont. This comes from Giselle Walton. Says, from another true crime host, I love this show. I've been listening for years, and once I started my own true crime podcast, I've started using this one for research on cases. Jamie and John are always so respectful, give great insight into the details of the cases. Truly a treasure. With love, Crimes and Cannabis.
Crimes and Cannabis. Well, That sounds like a good fun time.
Sounds like
is that review written at 4:20 p.m. just out of curiosity?
Was Brent Reeves knocking at your door? No, just kidding.
No, thank you. That's awesome. Guys, we have a new Patreon member that I want to thank. Tracy came in at the $3 level. So Tracy and all you other Patreon members will get a bonus episode each and every month. And on top of that, you get all of our regular content that's on our main feed a day early and ad free. So you don't want to miss out on that. There are multiple levels you can take advantage of. There's also a fun one. If you want to join for an annual membership, you can do so and take advantage of a 15% discount when you join any level at an annual membership.
I promise to read reviews from over on Paradigm, and I'll do that at the end of this episode. So stay tuned. If you've written a review, want to hear yours read aloud.
If you're new here, Paradigm is a brand new show that Jamie and I just released. It's got its own channel called Paradigm. We did a deep dive into the case of the Lily Lid family murders that took place in the late 1990s in Eastern Tennessee. It was a huge story. I remember it from my childhood, and we covered that case in 8 episodes. It's called Paradigm, the Lily Lid murders. You want to check that out for sure.
All right. We also have another good one here today, John. So why don't you go ahead and get us rolling with today's case?
All right. We're going to talk about Sharon Kinney. She was actually born Sharon Elizabeth Hall on November 30th, 1939. And she was born in Independence, Missouri. Her parents were Eugene and Doris Hall. They moved the family briefly to Washington State, but brought Sharon back to Missouri for high school. In the summer of 1956, when Sharon was just 16 years old, that's when she met 22-year-old college student James Kinney at a church function.
Now, the two dated that entire summer, but then James had to go back to school at BYU, which is Brigham Young University in Utah, in the fall. While he was back at school, he got a letter from Sharon, and she was writing to tell him that she was pregnant and the child was his. James did what he thought was the right thing. He took a leave of absence from school. He went back to Missouri to get married to Sharon. Now, part of the problem is that she was 16. They would get married on October 18th of 1956, just a few months after they had met, but they lied on the marriage license, saying that Sharon was a widow and that she was 18 years old. She actually started telling people she had been married to a man in Washington who had died in a car accident. And keep in mind, she left Washington when she was 15 years old. Sharon and James had another more formal wedding ceremony the following year at the Salt Lake Temple in Salt Lake City, Utah, after Sharon officially joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
As it turns out, Sharon never had the baby that she wrote to James about. She allegedly miscarried, but soon after the wedding, Sharon was pregnant again. The couple went back to Missouri and had their daughter, Dana, and eventually a son named Troy. James never finished his degree at BYU, but he did get a job as an electrical engineer, and Sharon did some odd jobs like babysitting and tending some shops on the side to make extra money. But the quiet suburban life was not very interesting to Sharon. She reportedly was a lavish spender who wanted the finer things in life, but their jobs did not offer them that luxury. Basically, they had a what I would call a champagne taste on a beer budget.
There you familiar? Go.
So while James worked nights, Sharon spent her days shopping and her nights out with other men. By the time they had their son Troy, she had started having an affair with her high school friend named John Boldes.
In early 1960, James was thinking about divorcing Sharon. Things had not been good, partly because of her spending and because he'd figured out that she was having these affairs with multiple men. So he went to his parents to ask for advice because it was against their religion. And he told them that Sharon had agreed to give him a divorce, but only if she got to keep the house, have custody of their daughter, and get $1,000 a month in alimony. Now, keep in mind, this was 1960. So that would be like asking for over $10,000 a month today. Unsurprisingly, James's parents, who were very faithful Mormons, pushed James to try to work it out and find a way to make his marriage with Sharon work.
Well, the day after James talked to his parents about divorcing Sharon, something tragic happened. Sharon said that around 5:30 p.m. on March 19th, 1960, she heard a gunshot from the direction of the bedroom where James was napping. Now, she says that she walked into the bedroom and found her 2.5-year-old daughter, Dana, on the bed next to her dad. When she walked in, Dana was holding James's .22-caliber pistol in her hands, and James was bleeding from a gunshot wound to the back of the head. So if this is true, then she just walked in on her daughter accidentally shooting her husband in the back of the head with his own gun.
Her 2-year-old daughter.
Right. Now, Sharon called the police, but before they could get him to the hospital, he had passed away. She told police officers that her husband often let Dana play with his guns, and friends and family confirmed that James did in fact love his guns, and it was not unusual for them to be setting out for his children to handle and to definitely get their hands on. Now, investigators realized that this is a 2.5-year-old child. Are they capable of even pulling the trigger? And the investigators tested Dana, and she was in fact able to pull the trigger on a similar gun to her dad's.
John, obviously, nobody's going to say that this is responsible gun ownership, but I can say that at that time in the 60s, even when I was younger, it wasn't as common to put your weapons in a locked safe or in a secure place that your kids couldn't reach them. It was just you talk to your kids about it and make sure that they know the dangers. But there have been so many accidents in my lifetime that I've heard about on the news, thankfully, and none have been really close to me, where the gun has accidentally gone off. So this was very unfortunate if it is what happened, but, you know, it's also hard to believe. Unfortunately, they didn't do any gunshot residue tests on Sharon or the little girl. So they don't know if the girl had even handled the gun, let alone shot it, or if maybe Sharon was the one that did it. And they weren't able to get fingerprints off of the pistol because it was recently oiled and it was very wiped clean. Now, this is a bizarre story, and there was no evidence to show that it wasn't true. So investigators decided to go ahead and rule this an accidental homicide by a minor, being Dana. The pistol that ended up killing James was taken into police custody and was never returned to Sharon, even though she tried really hard to get her back. John, you and I are both gun owners. I like to think we're responsible gun owners. If there was an incident with a gun hurting another person, no matter how close they were to you or not, if it was your gun, would you really want to have that around and look at it all the time?
I have an everyday carry that if something tragic like that happened, absolutely not. I would not want it back. On the other hand, I do have a weapon that is just extremely sentimental to me. And even with the tragedy, I would probably still want that back because of who gave it to me. But God, I hope I'm never in that situation. This is a great time to just remind people that if you do have weapons, please take precautions to lock them up and to keep them safe out of kids' fingers to touch.
Yeah, there are so many available resources to do so. So many different kinds of lock boxes and weapons at this point are easy to just take the clip out. Make sure you've cleared it before you, if you are going to put it somewhere. So just be careful. Kids don't know any better for the most part, especially if they're under 4 years old, right? And she's 2.5 here. So Sharon was pretty frustrated that police wouldn't let her have this weapon back. And we don't know the history of the weapon. We don't know if it was a family heirloom of some kind or whatever. But Sharon apparently just really wanted a gun. She had a male friend of hers go and buy her another .22 caliber pistol. This friend told Sharon that he had registered the gun in her name. And Sharon asked him to go back and change it to the name of anybody else. She didn't want this gun in her name, which, I mean, this is the 1960s before people are doing all kinds of research on ownership, I would think. So to hear somebody say that they did not want their name associated with this gun at that time, especially, I think would be really suspect.
I think it's also a sign of the times that that man could purchase the gun and put it in her name without her being there or agreeing to it.
Yeah.
Because that would not happen today.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, too. Now that the case about James's death was closed, they were able to bury him, and Sharon collected $29,000 in life insurance, which is about $230,000 today. So a fairly substantial life insurance policy was cashed in. And anytime there's a suspicious murder and a big payout, it's pretty typical to ask questions.
I would like for us to be able to sit here and tell you all the responsible things that Sharon did with this money, like paying off a house and making sure that her children were taken care of. But we've already talked about her spending problem. And as far as we know, one of the first things that she went out and bought was a brand new Ford Thunderbird. Now, I will go on the record to say that is, in fact, an awesome car.
Awesome car.
But for now, a single mom, probably not the wisest thing to do. Now, that is when she also met Walter Jones. They met on April 18th, 1960, which was 1 month after her husband was shot and killed. Walter was a former Marine who was married with two children of his own in the town of Independence. And Walter's wife, who's named Patricia Jones, was one of six children from St. Joseph, Missouri. She and Walter were high school sweethearts, and while he sold cars, she worked as a file clerk for the IRS. By 1960, Walter and Patricia had been married for nearly 5 years, but that did not stop Sharon from flirting or Walter from straying. Now, Sharon saw Walter as a potential new husband, but Walter had no interest in leaving Patricia. In May, Sharon told Walter that she was pregnant and that it was his.
She said that before.
Sharon probably thought that this was going to be what he needed to get him to leave Patricia, but instead, he simply ended the affair with Sharon. Now, he probably wanted to go and work things out with his wife because she was also expecting a baby.
I also think he didn't fully believe Sharon for whatever reason. I don't know if it's because some type of precautions they took or timing or whatever, but he was pretty sure that she wasn't pregnant with his child. On May 26th of 1960, Sharon contacted Patricia at her workplace. She called and said that her sister was having an affair with Walter and that Patricia should meet her to talk about it. So this is very quick revenge here from Sharon to try to get back at Walter for not leaving Patricia to be with her. Patricia was certainly curious about this. She didn't know who this was, but she wanted to know more. So she asked the man who ended up taking her to work daily, she carpooled, to drop her off at a spot in town where she could meet with this woman to talk about the woman's sister's affair with Patricia's husband.
That's a tangled web of lies, isn't it?
There's a lot going on here. And unfortunately, this is the last time that we ever see Patricia alive. When Patricia didn't come home that evening, Walter filed a missing persons report and immediately started calling people he thought might know where Patricia was or that may have seen her recently. He spoke to the guy that had driven Patricia to work that day, and he told him that he saw Patricia get in the car with a woman that he didn't know. But once he gave Walter a description, he knew who Patricia had left with. So he had his ideas of what had happened to his wife. When we get back from the break, we'll dig into how he called her out.
We've only communicated via text.
Don't tell him it's a wrong number. Have some fun with it. Play along.
You don't know who you have really been messing with.
Why would you have a duffel bag full of cash?
You're not so big and bad when you're not behind your phone.
Next time you may not make it out alive.
You don't work here.
Stop, Nick.
Freeze. Drop the bag and get on the ground.
One thing at a time. First, the cash.
You know you're not the only option I have, right?
You're behind this whole thing, aren't you?
No, this wasn't supposed to happen.
It's over for you.
No, 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 no.
Why is this happening?
From the makers of True Crime Cast, find the fictional mystery Left on Dead wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
So, quick recap. Patricia is now missing, and with that being the case, Walter called Sharon, and she admitted that she had met up with Patricia, but that she dropped Patricia off later that evening, and Walter was furious. I mean, not only is his wife missing, but now he knows that his wife Patricia knows something because he met with Sharon.
Yeah, so he knows met with Sharon. Them being together is worst case scenario for him, or at least he thought it would have been before he found out what really happened.
Sharon told him that she just wanted to help out. And after she spoke with Walter, she called her old friend and lover, John Boldus. Now, this was the guy that she had some rendezvous with in high school, right? So she asked John to help her search for her friend's missing wife. And shortly before midnight, the pair decided to pull up to an old lover's lane. Not sure what they had in mind, but it's kind of an odd timing, right? I mean, I don't know. They had been searching all day, and they wanted to break together. Now, it was supposedly John's idea to go to this spot, but it was the place that Sharon knew all too well, and that's the place where they found the body of Patricia Jones.
How convenient is that? You look for her all day, you go somewhere to be alone and make out, among other things, and you discover the person you were looking for. The body had been dressed in a black sweater and a yellow skirt, and she had been shot four times with a .22 caliber pistol. Her cause of death came from a gunshot wound through the front of her head, but she had other gunshot wounds in her abdomen and in her shoulder. There were powder burns all over her skirt's hemline, which showed that at least one shot happened at really close range, likely the fatal shot. Her time of death was estimated to be about 9 p.m. on May 27th, of 1960, the day that Sharon had met up with her.
Now, investigators first questioned Sharon, Walter, and John, of course. Walter and John both agreed to give written statements in which they admitted that each had dated Sharon, and both agreed to take lie detector tests. However, Sharon was willing to give a verbal statement, but not a written statement, and she refused to do a polygraph test. Investigators continued to search the murder scene for the weapon, and they were searching in the area around Patricia's body or the area where it had been found. Dude, this is crazy. They even enlisted the help of a local Boy Scout troop to search the woods for the .22 caliber pistol and the slug that went through Patricia. Now, today it's 2023, about to be 2024. I'm pretty certain that we would not enlist the help of a Boy Scout troop to do this search.
I'm shocked they did this in 1960. I mean, to bring kids into this, you just discovered a dead body. What if there are other bodies they're going to stumble upon? This is a crime scene. If you're wanting not to contaminate it, you don't need a bunch of little boys. That's the maybe the worst type of contamination you can put into it. And what if they pick it up and rub the fingerprints off? Like, it's just a horrible idea all around, but I guess hindsight's 2020.
I'm not trying to make light of this, but I mean, could you just imagine, like, there wasn't like a remind text that went out, but the phone call, like, hey guys, local troop 67 is going to meet up at the old Lover's Lane. We're going to look for the gun that was used to kill a woman.
Yeah, that conversation.
Have your kids there by 8. Breakfast will be provided. Like, could you imagine?
Yeah, that's an odd conversation to have, I would think.
All right, well, going back to the search, even police officers looking for this weapon were dragging the bottom of nearby bodies of water, looking for anything they could find, including the gun. And a slug was eventually found buried in the ground where Patricia's body had been found, but the pistol itself was never found.
On May 31st, Sharon was arrested at her home for the murder of Patricia Jones. Sharon hired some attorneys. Again, she had some money since her husband had passed away, and they filed a writ of habeas corpus with the court the next morning, and Sharon was released on $20,000 bond while she awaited trial. Police continued investigating. They ruled out the gun that was used to kill James as the same one to kill Patricia. It was in police custody. Then a man who had worked with Sharon admitted to having secretly purchased a new gun for her, said she had asked him to do it, and he put the .22 caliber pistol originally in her name, told them the whole story. Police couldn't find that gun anywhere around Sharon's house, where she worked, but they did find an empty box that they believe that gun came in when it was purchased. Sharon told investigators that she had lost the gun on a trip to Washington, but then she changed her story, saying that it just simply was disappeared and must have been stolen. So an inconsistency here of what happened to the gun certainly doesn't help her case.
Yeah, Sharon was charged with the murder of Patricia Jones and her husband, James Kinney. It was determined that she would be tried for each murder separately. Both trials had to be postponed due to Sharon actually being pregnant, and she did give birth to a daughter, Marla Christine, who was born on January 16th, 1961, with the father allegedly being Walter. Sharon's trial for Patricia's murder began June of 1961, and it had an all-male jury. Now, in that case, prosecution called 27 witnesses and rested its case after 8 days. Sharon's defense took less than 2 days, and Sharon herself did not testify. When the trial wrapped up, the jury deliberated for about an hour and a half, which in my mind, Jamie, seems short for the amount of time that we heard the trial lasted.
And, you know, I think you can make an argument either way, but I would think a quick decision would mean that it was clear that somebody's guilty would be my, if you're the defense, I would think a quick decision is a bad sign.
Well, that's what I would think too, Jamie. But in that time, they acquitted Sharon, saying that there were just too many loopholes in the prosecution's case. Immediately after the verdict was announced, one juror asked Sharon for her autograph. What in the world? Now, as she gave it to him, a photographer snapped a photo, and that picture was used in newspapers which covered the trial. Sharon was sent back to jail to await the trial for her husband's murder. That trial would begin on January 8th, 1962. The prosecution centered around Sharon's need to have her husband removed in order for her to get his life insurance money. Now, they called the man that Sharon had been unfaithful with, which was John, and John said that Sharon offered to pay him $1,000 to kill her husband. But while on the stand, John backtracked and said that Sharon might have been joking.
So John had seen her, the John in our story, John Boldus, not you, John, had seen her be acquitted for another crime that you have to think he knows she committed. So I have to think in the back of his mind, he's worried, you know what, if I point my finger at her and she's acquitted again, maybe I'll be next, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird that he would put himself in the middle of all this, because up until this point, I hadn't heard anything about that.
Yeah. On January 11th of 1962, Sharon was convicted after the jury this time deliberated for 5.5 hours. Sharon told reporters that she felt the verdict was a mistake, and she regretted this time having a woman on the jury. She had had all men the first time, which, again, would hopefully not happen today. But James's family also didn't believe the verdict. They told reporters, "We can't find it in our hearts to say anything bad about her, and we still don't feel that she committed the murder," which I think is a pretty odd thing to happen. I guess it's possible that his family was supportive here, but it would also be hard for me as a family member to believe that his 2-year-old daughter did it. In April of that same year, 1962, Sharon was formally sentenced to life in prison for the murder of her husband, James. She was serving her time at the Missouri Reformatory for Women.
The week after her sentencing, Sharon's lawyers requested that she be released on bond. They had a community petition signed by 132 of Sharon's supporters. The motion was denied in April of 1962 because first-degree murder was not a bailable offense, and she was already convicted, so I don't even know why they would ask this. That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
Now, the judge told Sharon's lawyers that their involvement in such a petition was highly improper, and I would agree. Then the defense team submitted the motion that requested the conviction be vacated for a lot of reasons, including procedural errors, a juror taking incomplete notes, disputes over John's testimony, and incorrect number of potential jurors being provided for the selection. Now, that motion was denied in April of 1962, but ultimately appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court. They reversed the conviction in March the next year, 1963, and ordered that a new trial, saying Sharon's defense was denied adequate peremptory challenges during jury selection in her trial. In July of 1963, her brother, Eugene, posted a $25,000 bond for his sister, and Sharon was released from jail.
So we're now 4 years removed from James's murder, but the trial, the second trial for his murder, started on March 23rd of 1964. Jury selection this time was long. So the first day of the trial ended up going for 14 hours, starting at 9 in the morning and not ending till around midnight. The judge had decided that because of the popularity of this case, of the autograph picture, of the mishaps that happened in the first case, that he would sequester the jury this time. And again, this time was an all-male jury, just like the time she was acquitted earlier. A couple days after the first day of the trial, it was discovered that a law partner of the prosecution had once been hired by one of the jurors, so a mistrial was declared before it could even really get going. Sharon's third trial also had a lengthy jury selection process to avoid the issues from the first one. Prosecution again called John Boldus to the stand, and he again said he didn't know if Sharon asking him to kill her husband was a joke or if it was serious, but this time he added that Sharon had asked him not to tell authorities about the offer, which gave credence to the idea that it was legit. There was also a witness, a friend of Sharon, who testified that she had once joked that the woman should get rid of her old man like Sharon did. This time, Sharon did take the stand, which at this point is her fourth trial for murder. This time is the first time we've seen her take the stand to deny all charges. The jury went to deliberation and ended up being deadlocked. In a case like this, it has to be a unanimous decision that wasn't reached, so we get another mistrial.
So her fourth trial for this case, which was ultimately her fifth trial in total, was scheduled for October 1964, But in September of 1964, Sharon was still out on bond. So she did what most people would do. No, I'm kidding. She decided to go to Mexico with her lover, Francis Samuel Pugliese, while her children stayed with James's mother. Legally, she was allowed to leave the country, but her contract with the company that posted her bond required her to get written permission to leave Missouri. And she did not do that, so she was now a wanted felon. So the two crossed the border, and they checked into a hotel as husband and wife. And Sharon claims that she felt unsafe in a foreign country, so she brought along a pistol with her.
Of course she did. The night of September 18th of 1964, Sharon left the hotel room, allegedly on her own, and then she met a man named Francisco Parades Ordonez at a bar. He was a Mexican-American that happened to be in Mexico at the time. And she went with Francisco back to his room at a different hotel. According to Sharon, Francisco started making sexual advances toward her that were unwelcome, and she fired her gun that she had taken with her to protect herself. Francisco had multiple gunshot wounds in the chest, killing him instantly. After hearing the gunshots, hotel employee Enrique Martinez Rueda came into the room. Sharon shot at him too, and ended up hitting him once in the shoulder. Enrique left the room and locked it behind him, trapping Sharon inside, and he called the police, reporting that she was on a shooting spree.
Police did not believe Sharon's story. They theorized that she had gone out that night looking for someone to rob. And when Francisco refused to give Sharon his money, police believe Sharon shot at him. Now, police searched Sharon's purse and found a gun with 50 cartridges inside the purse. They searched her hotel room with Francis and found more guns and cartridges.
If you want a weapon to defend yourself, you don't need 50 cartridges. A cartridge is basically a round. It's the bullet combined with the casing and that kind of thing. Yeah.
They took Francis into custody and charged him with entering the country illegally and carrying an unlicensed weapon. Ballistics showed that the gun found in their room was the same one that killed Patricia Jones, but Sharon was already acquitted of that crime, so they could not charge her again. That's double jeopardy.
Yeah, basically you just can't be charged for the same crime twice. There are times when it gets a little tricky, but it's unfortunately pretty clear here. She'd been acquitted of that crime, so they can't put her back on trial.
But we do have a dead Francisco. So the two were charged with his murder in the summer of 1965. Francis was cleared of all charges and deported to the U.S. Sharon was convicted in October and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
For murder.
Right. She appealed the conviction, and it resulted in an even longer sentence. We've covered a case like this recently where you appeal trying to get a shorter sentence, and they realize they can actually give you more, and they do so.
Yeah, and in her case, just knowing everything else we know, I support that. Generally, I think it's maybe not the best practice for lawmakers to have that ability, but fully supportive here. Go Mexico.
Yeah. So the Superior Court that heard the appeal thought that 10 years was actually too lenient, so they added 3 additional years and made it a 13-year sentence.
Still too lenient.
Yeah, but it also makes you question whether or not you want to file another appeal, because at that point they could double it.
Or right.
Yep. 16 years.
Too risky.
Now, in her Mexican women's prison, she was given the nickname Pistolera, which basically means the gunfighter. And the Mexican press started using that name for Sharon.
On December 7th of 1969, Sharon wasn't present for her routine roll call in prison. Her absence was not officially noted until she was also not present for a second roll call that happened that evening. The news of her escape was not reported to police until 2 the next morning, so she potentially had a full day of being escaped before they actually reported it, and they started a manhunt to find Sharon. They alerted the FBI that Sharon was on the loose and maybe trying to get back in the United States. When she did not appear in court for her fourth trial, an arrest warrant was issued for Sharon Kinney for evading capture and for not appearing in court.
Initial thoughts were that Sharon had bribed a guard to look the other way when she escaped prison, and that coincided with an unusual blackout that happened that had been reported at the prison the same time Sharon would have escaped. Further investigation into the prison showed that security there was pretty lax and really understaffed. There were other theories that included that Sharon may have enlisted the help of a boyfriend who was a Mexico City policeman. They also speculated that maybe her mom was involved and that she was involved in this escape plan, that Sharon may have disguised herself as a man to escape, or that even Francisco's family helped her escape and then killed her in retaliation for their loved one's murders.
And there's no way to know whether that really happened or not, because Sharon Kinney has never been seen again. More than 50 years have passed since her escape. Her arrest warrant in Missouri is the oldest outstanding murder warrant in that area. Her status in the Mexico prison system is also outstanding. But at the time of her escape, jailbreaks were not a crime, so if she were apprehended, she would just need to finish out her sentence of 13 years in Mexico. And that's kind of the end. We don't know what happened to Sharon Kinney after she left the Mexico prison. She seems to have killed many people. We know that she killed Francisco. We have a lot of reasons to believe she killed Patricia and her husband as well. And who's to say how she got out of prison and what she did there? I think a 13-year sentence is laughable for a murder, no matter the circumstances in her situation with as many rounds as they found and that kind of thing. And I think a lot of this could have been prevented, John, if they would have done a more thorough investigation into her husband's death and, I don't know, tried to take some gunshot residue tests to see if her daughter really had handled the gun or if maybe Sharon was just lying to the police, because in retrospect, she did that a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, I need a good timeline of when was that gunpowder test available to police. I bet it was available back then, and I think you're right. A more thorough investigation could have, you know, resulted in her in jail back then and spared the lives of so many people. So, man, what an interesting case. I almost feel like, I don't know, is it crazy to think this has similarities to me for like Frank Abagnale, who, I mean, he didn't, as far as I know, he never murdered anybody, but he got away with so much. And I feel like she did too.
She did. She was very believable for some reason. She fled to other countries and escaped prison. So there's certainly a hint of that con man, con woman, con person identity within Sharon Kinney. And unfortunately, at this point, we may never know. I don't think justice was served for James or Patricia or Francisco. And at this point, I don't think it ever will be.
Yeah, I think you're right, man. That's going to wrap this case up. Jamie, I know you have some Paradigm reviews that you're going to read. So, guys, thank you for listening to us today. And thank you for checking out Paradigm, which is a brand new podcast that we've put out. It's available on its own feed. You can look it up by looking for Paradigm, The Lily Lid Murders.
Yeah, I read a couple of those last week. Going to drop a couple more today. This comes from L'Oreal M. Ross. It says, job well done again, gentlemen. Two of the best podcasters around. Always look forward to new content. And no matter the format, they do not disappoint. Keep up the good work. Thank you to L'Oreal. This comes from RodDog4OH5. So glad to see these fellers taking a deep dive into this. We appreciate that. And I love being called feathers. So thank you, Rod Dog. And just one more for this week. This comes from Alvin13242. I really enjoy listening to your show. I'm a OTR truck driver and listen every day on my drive time. It's very enjoyable for me to figure out who maybe the killer is in a missing person case. We really appreciate all those reviews, and we have a few more to get to next week. Keep those coming in, and we'll keep reading them here, because Paradigm, we think this show, True Crime Cast, is more of a storytelling podcast, whereas Paradigm is more of an investigative look that could warrant action. So we'd love to have more people listening over there and giving us your opinion, but that's going to do it for today. We'll be back Friday with another crime story in 10 minutes or less.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast. Crime.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.